Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The moment the midterms were over, the QE2 steamed into Washington. Not the cruise liner, but the Federal Reserve's new policy, quantitative easing round two. Basically, it means electronically printing more than $500 billion, throwing them at the weak embers of the economy, and hoping those embers finally, really, burst into flame. But even QE2's backers say that may not happen, that the best hope may be keeping us from a backslide to more recession. And there are risks. This hour on Point, the Fed moves big again to try to save the economy. We'll talk this hour with two big economists about the Fed's latest gamble. But to explain what QE2 really is, let's start with Sewell Chan, Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Sewell, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So Ben Bernanke is saying, what, they're going to take something like $600 billion, maybe more, and buy long-term treasuries with it. What's the idea?
Right. They're buying treasury securities with an average maturity of 5 to 6 years, actually. So you could say they're sort of medium to long-term. Mm-hmm. And the goal of this is that when the treasury goes in and buys bonds, it's creating money. By buying these bonds, it drives up the cost of these bonds because there's more demand for them. For bonds, the yields or the interest paid on those bonds goes down when the price goes up. So by driving up the price of these bonds, the Fed is lowering these long-term yields. What does this mean for ordinary people? The idea is that if longer-term interest rates are lowered, that could affect a whole bunch of other rates, like, for example, the 30-year mortgage rate. And that could help make it easier for consumers and for businesses to spend, to borrow, and to invest and ultimately get the economy going again. Why is the Fed doing this now?
Yeah.
They've already exhausted their main policy tool, which is lowering short-term interest rates. And the Fed can do that much more easily, and the Fed already did that. It lowered those short-term rates in December of 2008 to just about zero, and it has kept them there at zero for nearly 2 years now. But now they clearly feel that's not enough.
And this is not tinkering. This is a lot. This is even more than many people expected that was announced yesterday.
That's right. In the first round of quantitative easing, the Fed, over a 15-month period that ended last March, bought about $1.7 trillion worth of mortgage-backed securities, including debts owed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are now under government conservatorship, and government securities. And now they're buying at least $600 billion more, the idea being that the last time may not have been enough.
Now, Ben Bernanke is obviously feeling some need to explain himself. He's in the Washington Post this morning with an op-ed piece saying, look, we are ordered by law, by Congress, to promote employment and to work against inflation. To guard against inflation, he says, we've got to do it in this instance. But he clearly feels the need to explain. Not everybody's happy about this.
That's right. Traditionally, there's the tension within the Fed is between those who are most worried about inflation, who are known as hawks, commonly known as hawks, and those who are most concerned about unemployment, commonly known as doves. But in this case, that tension is kind of broken down because inflation is so low and unemployment is so high that there isn't necessarily a tension between fixing the one and the other. And so Bernanke is arguing that the two legal mandates that the Fed has to maintain price stability and to promote maximum employment, it's not really meeting either of those mandates really well right now, not because, you know, the Fed's bad or anything necessarily, but just because the economic situation is so dire and the magnitude of the and severity of the financial crisis that we've been through so great that inflation is running at about half what the Fed would like it to be, and unemployment at nearly 10% is running much more higher than any of us would like it to be.
I said inflation, you say price stability, and I guess the difference there is that price stability means you're also watching out for deflation, which people are afraid of right now.
Exactly, and that, Tom, is the exact conversation going on within the Fed. The U.S., many U.S. economists are very concerned about the U.S. slipping into, or as you put it, backsliding into, a real period of economic stagnation similar to the deflationary period that Japan has struggled with off and on since the 1990s.
You quote Robert Gordon, the economist at Northwestern University, saying that there's a very big chance of that happening, of the U.S. economy heading into a lost decade, and it's pretty, I mean, the sort of how he lays that out is pretty rough. He says it would be, if that happens, it will be tougher for us than for Japan, he told you, because we've got a higher unemployment, we've got less social safety net, our medical insurance is tied to employment here, not there, we've got greater inequality, and we've got higher levels of poverty. So if we hit a Japan-style long, bleak patch, it'll be double bleak.
That's right, and that's the sort of a nightmare scenario that a lot of economists have right now, Tom.
Is Ben Bernanke worried about that? Does this step make it obvious that he's worried about just that?
Well, his official perspective certainly is that the risk of deflation is very, very low, and the Fed continues to project that the economy is going to keep growing. It has been growing, right? The recession officially ended last summer.
1.5%, 2%, yep.
Exactly. Most Americans don't feel it's great because with growth so low, only about 2% a year, that is not sufficient to bring the unemployment down. Our labor force grows by roughly that percentage any year, so we have to be generating more than 2% to keep pace with the growth in our population and the growth in our labor force. So things are dire right now. It's interesting that Bernanke's here because he devoted his career, his scholarship as a Princeton professor, to this very topic of how to avoid deflation. The only experience the U.S. has had with it on a sustained basis in modern times is the Depression. And Bernanke's lifetime of scholarship was dedicated to the very question of how to avoid deflation. And one of his conclusions was that central banks with sufficient resolve and determination can, in fact, avoid deflation.
The man and the moment meet. It's not exactly uncanny. He's at the helm of the Fed right now because he studied that, perhaps. There are risks here. And one that people talk about is inflation. The other is that they'll just take this huge step and it won't work. Let's look first at inflation. The president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City, Thomas Hoenig, is calling this plan a dangerous gamble, a bargain with the devil, and inflation is what he's worried about. Why?
Right. So the idea is that the Fed, by taking all this action, is pumping so much money in. And when the time comes to take the money back out, there is a worry that the Fed will not be able to do it quickly and adroitly enough. And if that happens, then that could touch off a lot of inflation in the future. A related worry is that by taking this bold action, investors will get very nervous. If they get nervous, then their impressions, and this is really, you know, kind of psychological more than anything, their impressions of what future inflation will look like will go up. And that could actually have a real material consequence in raising long-term interest rates, which is the exact opposite of what the Fed would want. So far, those inflation expectations, which are measured by things like surveys, but also by instruments known as inflation-protected securities that people buy to insure themselves against future inflation. So far, those inflation expectations have stayed what economists called anchored. They haven't really moved that much. The fear is that if they get unmoored or untethered, then we could be in for a big problem.
Now, there's the risk, obviously, that it doesn't work, and the Fed never wants to look ineffectual because part of its power is in that it will come in and do big things and they will have consequences. But there's another risk here, which is not exactly trade war, but close to it, currency war. This pushes the dollar down, and there's been a kind of race all around the world to get currencies down for trade advantage. There's been some yelping and outcry from emerging economies yesterday and today, Sewell. I'm sure you've seen it. Why are they unhappy with this move?
Sure. So you look at the whole world, the richest countries on earth, like United States, Western Europe, Japan, Canada, these countries are growing much more slowly than countries like in Latin America and East Asia, China, Brazil, Turkey, South Korea.
A bunch of them are booming along, and in fact, they've got much higher growth, and they have inflation issues right now.
Exactly. They have much higher inflation. They're worried about bubbles being created in their economies as investors from the rich countries who aren't getting any savings, making a lot of money on their savings, they're going overseas in search of higher yields. And so the question is whether the U.S., having just experienced and recovered from our own, begun to recover from our own housing bubble, whether we're now inadvertently generating housing and other asset price bubbles in other countries around the world.
There's also the complaint about this that it's really inefficient, that if Congress were putting a stimulus up, the president and or Congress or together, this wouldn't be necessary. You quote James Galbraith, economist, saying, that fiscal measures, that is the kind of spending Congress could do, would do something. They would get directly into the economy. This is roundabout, is his complaint, and it'll end up flooding the banks with cash, he says, which they will use, if at all, for speculating rather than lending. Is Ben Bernanke doing this because something's got to be done and Congress isn't doing it?
Well, there's certainly the argument that, you know, nothing is better than, I mean, that nothing is not an option, mm-hmm. that things are so dire right now that for the Fed to just sit on its hands would be the worst thing. That said, I think there's clearly a sense among many economists that the best policy would be a combination of monetary accommodation, which Bernanke is clearly providing, with some degree of fiscal support. Now, what nature and what that support should look like, that is obviously a subject of bitter, bitter partisan dispute. And frankly, it's not entirely clear, and I don't mean this in a and this is just an observation. It's very, very unclear right now mm-hmm. what the new Republican base that's taken control of the House wants in terms of its fiscal plans. Those plans were not really spelled out during the last campaign. I suspect that there's very much a camp that's in favor of immediate austerity, but then there's also a group that's very much in favor of extending all the tax cuts, which kind of cuts both ways because it provides right. some immediate relief, mm-hmm. perhaps, but it also much more worsens the long-term deficit picture.
But it's been a solid block against stimulus, I could say, and Tea Partiers, Rand Paul, et cetera, have been very frosty toward the Fed for a long, long time. Here it is, taking the lead. Sewell Chan with the New York Times, please stand by in Washington. When we come back, economists Jeremy Siegel and John Taylor join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Fed stepping in big on the flagging economy, printing money, in effect, lots of it, to try to drive down long-term interest rates even further, hoping people will lend and spend. It's called quantitative easing. It's the second round. We've been talking with Sewell Chan, Washington correspondent for The New York Times, who's been all over this move. We'll hear in just a moment from Jeremy Siegel at the Wharton School in Philadelphia. John Taylor joins us right now from Stanford, California, professor of economics at Stanford University, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He was undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs under George W. Bush, served on the President's Council of Economic Advisors in the Ford and George H.W. Bush administration. John Taylor, thanks very much for being here.
Good to be here, Tom. Thank you.
You are not a fan of this step by Ben Bernanke. Why not?
There's basically, I think, the benefits are small or nearly zero, and the costs are quite high in terms of risks to the economy. So that's the basic reason. And the costs are partially that this will have to be removed. You put a lot of money in the economy. We already put a lot of money in the economy. It'll have to be removed, and that's what I worry about. Could be quite destructive just at the time we need it. And, of course, we have to pull it out, as Stuart mentioned, because ultimately there'll be some inflation. So I look at this empirically, look at what happened with QE1, and I see this is a sort of a repeat of something that has not worked, and I worry about it quite a bit.
We've got Jeremy Siegel with us as well right now, professor of finance at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania, author of The Future for Investors. Jeremy Siegel, you've been for this. You've applauded Ben Bernanke on taking this step, this second big round of quantitative easing, the $600 billion, maybe more. Why are you for it?
Yes. Hello, Tom. Hello, John. No, I think this is absolutely the right policy at this time. You know, we've been talking about how slow this recovery has been. And I think what we really need, and I know it seems like the banks have so much excess reserves, but they want to hold those. But if the Federal Reserve is what is doing quantitative easing, providing more reserves in the system, I think that's going to give that extra push that's going to get the banks to start lending again and get people to start putting their money more in risk assets, which they've been so adverse to doing up till now.
Well, they've been putting it lately in risk assets in the stock market in anticipation of this step. And the stock market, at least at this hour, up again today. But unemployment also up, Professor Siegel. I mean, in the end, the stock market alone, or if this is good for, you know, sort of the money gang, it's not the same as necessarily as good for Main Street or people who need jobs.
Well, we know it's going to be reflected first in the market before we're going to see it in the economic statistics. I heard Sewell's excellent summary, just before our segment, and I think the nervousness. I don't think there's nervousness on the part of investors. I think what we saw, see today, and the immediate reaction is, yeah, we do want this. And remember, when markets go up, and particularly the stock market, which almost half the Americans have some direct investment in, that makes people feel better, and in and of itself can help the economy.
John Taylor, do you have a concern whether or not it sparks inflation, that it could set off another bubble here and or abroad?
Absolutely. Abroad, at first abroad, because as you mentioned earlier, other countries, especially emerging markets, are really booming. They're concerned about their own inflation. Their central banks, many of them, would like to raise interest rates, and this kind of move makes it more difficult for them to do that. And if that happens, I hope it doesn't, then it comes back to the United States in terms of an inflation problem. So it's very much so. Jeremy mentioned the stock market. He's the expert on the stock market. But as I see the movements recently, the stock market bottomed in July. People were relieved there wasn't a double dip. It was moving along. We had a very disruptive Federal Reserve meeting in August 10th. Market went back down. And when Ben Bernanke spoke to clarify that, it's moved up again. So I don't see much evidence that stock market moves are related to this quantitative easing at all. You never know. And I haven't seen much change in interest rates either. So, as I said before, the benefits are negligible in my view, but I'm very concerned about the risks. And what's holding the economy back, in my view, is uncertainty about policy. This just adds to the uncertainty. It's untested. Even the Fed doesn't know the size of the impact. And so that's sort of just the opposite of what we need right now. We need certainty about policy, predictability, so that firms can start hiring workers and have a better idea about the future.
We'll ask how that might be achieved. Sewell Chan there in Washington, if, as John Taylor describes it, the economy, sort of low but gurgling up and kind of steady, interest rates, inflation steady, what do you think is pushing Ben Bernanke at this point, at this moment, to take this big step? What's he looking at?
Well, I think the prospect of fiscal gridlock in Washington is actually weighing on him. I think that he sees no prospect for additional fiscal stimulus coming from Washington, and I think he has to make his decision against that political backdrop. The Fed very much tries to see itself as an institution that's above politics. Independence of the central bank is kind of a sacred mantra and principle at the Fed, but they do not make their decisions in a vacuum. They make them against a political context that I think right now is not looking very supportive of the kind of certainty that Mr. Taylor's talking about.
John Taylor, you've advised a lot of Republicans, presidents. You advised John McCain in his presidential campaign. What about it? If a Republican House is certain to block any more stimulus, what's on offer there to get this thing going? What are you/they suggesting?
Well, I think it's a mischaracterization. They're going to block stimulus. To me, probably the best stimulus right now would be to say we're not going to increase taxes next year. We're going to put off tax increases as far as we can.
Now, President Obama is saying that as well, but you mean for everybody, including
the— No, he's not saying that yet. I hope he says that.
He has already said it for most Americans, but not for the wealthiest Americans.
No, right now the taxes will increase. They're scheduled to increase in January on virtually everyone.
Yes.
They'll try to carve out some who won't get it. I think that whole process itself is disruptive because you don't know. The situation we're in now where a tax increase is scheduled is huge uncertainty. So I say the best stimulus to the economy right now, and I say this with all sincerity, would be to say we are not increasing anybody's taxes next year. That's the certainty that small businesses need. That's the certainty that investors need. Taxes on dividends, et cetera. And I think that would be a terrific stimulus to the economy.
Jeremy Siegel?
So when you say the blocking stimulus, I think that's when you mean is blocking big deficit spending stimulus packages like we had in 2009.
Yes.
And I think even the president doesn't think that did much good. So use the word stimulus, I think, in a way that includes sort of responsible fiscal policy.
I think the president has said on a number of occasions that he thinks that stopped the world from going into a severe depression. He may not be so hot on it now. I'm not sure. But Jeremy Siegel, what about it? Would it be enough just to stand back, keep taxes down for everybody, act to keep them from going up again, and there's stimulus enough?
Well, I think as a result of the election, the Democrats seem to be more willing to extend the tax cuts for everyone. And I think that that is another bullish factor for the stock market because, again, we're talking about dividend taxes. We're talking about capital gains taxes. It's a very interesting political situation, as we know, with the Republicans taking over the House. The Republicans have to agree, therefore, on the plan. Otherwise, all the tax cuts are going to expire at the end of December, which is going to be a disaster for the economy. The Democrats and Republicans know it. It's going to be a game of chicken. That's going to be fascinating, I think, to watch over the next 6, 7, 8 weeks. Probably the most important thing that Congress actually will engage in during their lame duck session.
But John Taylor's point is confirm low taxes at that rate, and you'll have certainty enough to get things going here. That's stimulus enough. You know, why do this QE2 quantitative easing with the risks that come along with it? Just keep the taxes down.
I think we need both. I'm certainly right with John in terms of let's extend tax cuts for everyone and on capital gains and on dividends for the next 2 years at least. Actually, I'd like to see it permanent, but clearly in this slow economic period. But why not provide an extra boost here with liquidity to get people, again, moving out on the risk curve, getting those banks saying, all right, I don't want to keep on earning, just a quarter of 1% on my reserves. There are better opportunities out here. Let's go for a little bit more loans, which I think is another thing that I think could spark some increase in lending, which is certainly one of the ingredients of economic growth in the U.S.
Let's go to our listeners. Morgantown, Kentucky. Eric, you're on the air with Jeremy Siegel, John Taylor, Sewell Chan. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, my comment is short and sweet, but it's an idea I've kicked around several times when they come out with the first stimulus package, and now this other one that everybody's referring to, QE2, and I'd love to hear your panel's ideas on this. Instead of putting that money in the bank, if you gave every American that pays taxes, works jobs, supports their families, facing foreclosures, whatever, and you divided that $600 billion or however many dollars by every American and said, here you go, do you think we'd really have the same problems we have 6 months from now than we do right now? Because if you put the money in the bank, people are reluctant to buy or borrow anything because they don't have a fail safe. Well, my direct idea would be a stimulus, but directly to the American people.
Just give them the cash. Don't depend on borrowing and lending. I don't know. John Taylor, how about it? I was talking with Joe Stiglitz not long ago. He said something, the economist, he said something similar, half facetiously, but maybe only half. He said, why don't you just, drop Home Depot gift cards from a helicopter over the country? More or less the same idea as Eric's got.
You know, we tried that kind of thing. Remember the cash for clunkers?
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of give people a little extra incentive to buy. It's not as big as what we're talking about now, but that came and went. It had a little stimulus, but it basically was offset in the next few months. And so you got to be careful with these sort of, I would call it a little gimmicky, but I think the caller is exactly right about the banks. They are sitting with $1 trillion of excess reserves right now. So to double that or increase that by 50%, I just don't see that does anything. The theory behind this quantitative easing, as Seward mentioned earlier, was to try to lower longer-term interest rates. And there's where we have debates about how effective it will be. And I don't really see, based on my research and carefully looking at QE1, I just don't see the impact. And so that's why I think the caller is onto something. But these kind of short-term gimmicks, that's why I go back to, if you could just agree not to raise taxes, that would put money in people's pockets compared to where they think they're going now, but kind of on a permanent basis. So we have a sustainable recovery, not one of these things that gets going like last year and then pauses this year. We need to get that 4% growth rate for several years to get unemployment down.
Sewell Chan, what's a short-term gimmick here? I mean, Eric in Morgantown says, you know, just get the cash out there. Joe Stiglitz on this front has written, has said recently, you know, there's a problem. I mean, big enterprises are flush with cash. They've got trillions that they're sitting on. And the lending channels, if this lowers interest rates, even so, lending channels are all blocked up and kind of sick. So, you know, is this a giant gimmick? Does it really get money out into the economy where it's going to make things happen?
Well, you have a really good point. I think a lot of economists, even those who favor quantitative easing, think that the effects of what the Fed announced yesterday will be modest at best, that it will, you know, have a little bit of an effect on increasing growth from where it would otherwise be, that it may, you know, lift the employment rate a little bit, but just a little bit, and that, you know, for more to happen will require both time and coordinated policy. You know, the interesting idea, I mean, I don't think the Fed can legally just print money and give it out to the American people.
But they can print it and give it to banks.
Well, I mean, they're putting liquidity into the system. They're not adding it to the as an asset
certainly.
To the bank. But it's I think for a nation of 300 million people, you know, even the $600 billion the Fed announced yesterday would amount to, my math is bad, but I think $20 per person or something like that.
Not exactly. Yippee yahoo. G. Ray in Brookline, Massachusetts. You're on the air, G. Ray.
Hi, Tom. Great show. Very disturbing topic. I'm going to make a quick comment, then I promise there's a question.
Okay.
I think this thing should be, instead of being called the QE2, should be called the Titanic. $600 billion of what's called quantitative easing, and I'm not sure why writers don't just call it what it is, which is money printing or counterfeiting. Now, through the magic of fractional reserve lending, I'm sure even Professor Siegel knows that $600 billion could turn into actually $10 trillion of cash in the system, okay? And that's without congressional debate, no votes, no authorization. Now, there's this myth that this is to promote, quote-unquote, full employment. Now, the reality, as Siegel pointed out, is to pump up the balance sheet of the banks to create inflation, to inflate asset prices, okay? Now, why don't the Germans want to do this? Well, because they know in 1922 it led to the rise of hyperinflation in Adolf Hitler. Inflation is a benefit to the creditor class to the debtor class at the expense of the creditor class. People that are regular people who don't own houses, who rent, poor people that don't benefit from inflation, they don't own land, they don't own assets. This thing is going to inflate the value of people who have real assets, and those are not poor people, those are rich people.
G. Ray, you've got a hot perspective there, and I've only got a minute before the break. I want to put that to Jeremy Siegel right here. Forgive me, G. Ray, it's terrific. But Jeremy, what do you say?
Well, first of all, you know, raising the asset prices is not what we call inflation, which is commodity prices, which is service prices, consumer price index. Bernanke and the Fed are committed against that. They will act against that. They want it a little bit higher than the 1%, 0.9% than we have, because we found that economies work fairly well at 2, 2.5. You know, they may even err a little bit higher.
But G-Ray's saying this is playing footsie with much bigger inflation. He's talking about Weimar.
He talked about inflation. Yeah. Well, and that absolutely I do not believe. First of all, what's happened is that multiplier that he talked about has been zero. We put reserves in and we've gotten no lending. So, you know, if we get just a little bit of lending, that's what we need. But the multiplier is nowhere what it used to be after the crisis.
Lots of callers. Susan, Iowa City, Iowa. You're on the air, Susan.
Thank you for taking my call. It's always an interesting discussion on this. I'm talking as a simple home economist who's old enough to remember the high interest rates of the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I have no choice, I feel, but to trust Ben Bernanke. But my big concern is that none of the pundits, nobody talking about the FICO scores. To me, the people that I deal with,
you mean credit ratings?
About their FICO scores.
You mean credit, personal credit ratings? How do you see that factoring in, Susan?
Because nobody wants to spend they can't go get new loans. Businesses are hard-pressed to get loans. I don't blame the banks for not wanting to loan with the FICO scores that people have, but to me, they're not realistic. They don't really reflect what people could be paying back to the banks.
What, you mean everybody's score got knocked down, or many people's, by the sort of brutal hit of the collapse?
Yes, and I don't think that they're really reflective of people's ability to borrow. And so I would like to see a huge discussion on the FICO scores.
Well, that's interesting. John Taylor, what about it? Instead of knocking down long-term interest rates, what if we just pump up everybody's credit rating by 150 points? See what happens.
Well, the most important thing is to have the credit ratings be credible, and so people can trust them. And so to the extent that they are not accurate or being exaggerated, I think that's something to try to correct. But I think it would be a mistake to just arbitrarily give people higher credit ratings who don't merit it. In many respects, that's how we got into this mess in the first place. It seems, certainly in retrospect, but many people at the time thought that the Fed was holding interest rates way too low. That encouraged a lot of risk-taking. That encouraged people to make loans to customers who might not be able to pay back, and that's what happened. They didn't pay it back. So there may be an overreaction, but certainly it's important not to get back to that kind of a bubble again, because it was so destructive. It's one of the dangers, by the way, if I could just add, of having monetary policy that's sort of too loose and too easy. It can be counterproductive. Everybody thought those low interest rates in 2003, 4, 5 were just great, got good mortgages. But it's caused a major problem now.
Of course, I mean, in effect, we've been cleaning up the bank's balance sheet sets them. In effect, cleaning up their credit ratings here, I suppose. We've got a comment for you, Professor Taylor, from John. This is from the website. He says, "Hey, John Taylor, you guys must be on a, personal basis. Remember, money talks, not policy uncertainty. Businesses," he writes, "invest when they can see the money, not when they can see the policy. Put money in people's hands to spend, and you'll get all the certainty you can stand." What do you say, Professor Taylor?
Well, I think you want to get money that's going to be sustainable, that will the businesses can say, "Hey, if I hire these extra workers, I'm going to be able to sell my product and be able to pay those workers." And that requires some looking into the future, maybe not years, but a little bit. So that confidence is so important. And in terms of just pushing money out, I do go back to the stimulus we had in 2008 with President Bush. They sent checks to people like that, put the money out there. People didn't spend it. It didn't jumpstart. In fact, the recession got much worse. So I think that's why this sustainability, long-term recovery, rather than these short-term fixes, are so important to emphasize.
Jeremy, here's another couple comments from the web, maybe for you. One from Boston says, "We're all effectively paying the interest on this free money to the banks." But here's another. Roberto says, "If all this QE2 does is increase banks' house credit, and then banks sit on cash hoards and don't loan it out, he says they should be taxed on the excess. Otherwise, it's effectively just one more entitlement, given to banks." He says, "Not many bankers suffered at bonus time last year, and they're on track to do pretty well again. It's just subsidizing that cash dole," writes Roberto. What do you say, Professor Siegel?
Well, first of all, reflecting a few maybe misunderstandings, the Fed is not giving $600 billion to the bank. It's exchanging $600 billion. It is buying $600 billion worth of government bonds that the banks hold, and therefore giving them the reserves. So it's not just an outright gift, it's an exchange. And the hope is that holding another $600 billion of reserves, I remember Susan said, how are we going to prompt them to land? They're only earning 0.25% interest on those reserves. That's extraordinarily low. Actually, I think the Fed should lower it back to zero, which it used to be, but that's another issue. The hope is when they see, these excess reserves, they say, "Listen, I'm holding a lot of excess reserves because, I'm worried about loans. I need bad loan reserves. Yep. I'm worried about the economy. If I get another slug of this, you know what? I think I'm going to take some of this and lend it out," because the margins are just so high now for the banks. So that's
because the
idea
money they're getting is so cheap that even if interest rates are low, it's a great margin.
That's exactly it. And that's the idea. But what Bernanke wants to do, that's one reason quantitative easing. We should not just look at the interest rate effect. I mean, my first 4 years of teaching was a colleague of Milton Friedman, University of mm-hmm. Chicago. And he was, if you remember, he was one of the people who said, and certainly John knows all about this too, said don't just look at interest rate effects, look at the liquidity effects, the quantity effects. And this, I think, is one of the important effects that we're going to see from QE2. And that is that extra reserves is going to really sort of put the banks to saying, yeah, now I think I can do a little more lending.
Sewell Chan, is that what you're hearing from the banking industry? Is this, another slug, one more slug, and that's going to unleash the flood of lending?
Well, certainly you're not hearing any opposition from the banking industry to this. I think in general, a lot of them prefer more liquidity in the system. And, in fact, the question really wasn't yesterday mm-hmm. whether the Fed was going to act. It was how much the Fed was going to act by. The Fed does a very good job of communicating its expectations. And some people on Wall Street were disappointed. They were hoping for even more purchases than what we got.
Wow. Steve in Providence, Rhode Island. Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, thanks. I feel like I've been around this barn with you on your show with other commentators, and I guess, here are my points. Maybe I'm just a stupid pedestrian citizen.
Doubt it.
First of all, this business about the upper tax brackets, let's say it's the above $250,000, and this merging of somehow this collapses with the small business owner. Small business owners personally don't make anything like that kind of money. So the notion that small business owners are holding back because they don't know what's going to happen, I think there are loads of studies, loads of economic commentators that just totally disagree with that assumption. That's one. The second thing is the assumption that the stimulus didn't work. You've got CBO and other nonpartisan groups saying unemployment would now be something like 12% if we hadn't had the stimulus. That's not an argument for more stimulus, although the irony is that if we're talking $600 billion now injected on top of the Obama stimulus of a year and a half or 2 years ago, there were people talking then about let's go for $1.3 trillion, let's go for $1.4 trillion.
Right.
That would be that amount. The last thing is I think a lot of these economists, all due respect to your commentators this morning, are navigating in a total unknown world. Read any of the stuff that Paulson, Bernanke, and these guys were dealing with, the Lehman Brothers execs and whatnot from the summer and fall of 2008, they have no idea what was going on. I'm not sure that a lot of people today have any real idea about what's going on.
Steve, let us pick it up. You've got a lot on the table. John Taylor, first to you. There is this ongoing struggle over the narrative of where we've just been. And, Steve's hip-checking you a little bit here on the assertion of upper-income tax brackets and small business being one and the same. We did see those studies saying, median income for many small business people not in that top bracket.
Well, if you look at the number of small businesses, he's right. But if you look at the size and the jobs created, it's quite significant. And in terms of uncertainty, which he mentioned, it's not just uncertainty about taxes. There's a lot of uncertainty about how the new regulations will be put in place, whether it's the health care or the financial services. So that's added uncertainty. So I think if you go around, you talk to business people, large firms, small firms, this idea of uncertainty is definitely out there, and I'm convinced it's a factor. Just on the stimulus effects, there is a disagreement amongst economists, or always is, I suppose, but they have different models, and the people you mentioned, CBO, they have one kind of model. Other people have different models, and those other models say it had almost no effect. I've tried to look at what actually happened. The grants were sent to the states, et cetera. And there really hasn't been much spending, infrastructure spending, the things that should make a stimulus work. So I'm really much on the side that this stimulus didn't do much good. Of course, I realize others disagree, but I think there's a growing understanding out there that the stimulus package, both by President Obama in 2009 and by President Bush in 2008, were not effective in helping the economy. And you can say, well, things would have been worse otherwise, but it's nearly impossible to prove that.
Sewell Chan, let me come to you as the reporter. I mean, the battles over the narrative now go all the way back to the New Deal, with the assertion that what FDR did didn't matter. But I have read many people saying we could be in the Great Global Depression without the stimulus. Is that a consensus? Is it full of holes? What do you say, Sewell?
Well, with all due respect to my two colleagues, and I've enjoyed very much talking with John Taylor, one of the challenges of economic journalism is that I think I'd be hard-pressed to find a single profession where there's such a divergence of perspectives. Yeah, even in some cases based on the same data. I mean, economists build very, very complex models and often use them to reach, you know, diametrically opposite conclusions. So it's a very, very difficult time right now to know, you know, where to go forward, to know how to isolate the effects of the regulatory policy that Dr. Taylor cites. It's very hard to know for sure the positive impacts of the QE that Professor Siegel cites.
Jeremy Siegel, I do want to look forward here, but just briefly on the stimulus and, you know, pulling us away from bigger depression and on this issue of uncertainty. Do you think that's a key issue now? John Taylor clearly does.
Yes, and I would like to comment just on what Steve's point is. Do we know what we are doing, or does the Fed know what we are doing? I mean, I certainly am one of the people who fault the Fed for not have seen this crisis coming. The buildup of risky real estate assets in these key financial institutions was, you know, certainly an important failure.
But that was Fed policy too.
Yeah. Well, but then once the crisis happened, which they didn't see and could have, you know, ameliorated greatly, I think the policy has been excellent. QE1 is what prevented us from rolling into Depression 2. And no, it didn't get us right out. I mean, and that's what QE2 is designed to do. Our QE1 stabilizes the situation, prevents a depression like the 1930s. QE2 now is designed to start moving us back into a growing economy. So I think that, you know, yes, there was a failure on seeing those risks, but I would say right now the policy is on track in the right way to bring about a recovery.
Just talk to us about the risk here, the big picture. We were talking earlier in the hour about Bob Gordon at Northwestern, and he's saying, you know, there's a substantial chance of the U.S. economy heading into a lost decade, like Japan has had, but he said much worse because we have higher unemployment, less safety net, don't have universal health insurance, greater inequality, greater poverty. How big is that risk in your view, Jeremy Siegel?
Well, I think that's what Bernanke's QE2 is designed to prevent. Don't forget, the last decade, Japan has had deflation. And once they got into deflation, which they didn't stop right away, it's very hard to get out. Bernanke does not want to get into that trap. He wants to say, all right, I want to make sure we don't get into the Japanese deflationary trap. And that's why I'm moving now. And that's why I do not believe that we are going to have the lost decade because of the moves that Bernanke and the Federal Reserve are now making.
So you're optimistic that this liquidity
Yes.
will get out into the economy. I guess that's the only way it really...
Yes.
Paint a picture for us of how that would happen, the optimistic picture you've got there.
Well, the optimistic picture is that it will spark more lending on the part of banks.
Because
the margins are so high, and then they're going to get more liquidity than they need. It's going to entice people, I think, as we certainly are seeing today, into the stock market, beginning to say, I'm getting nothing on my money funds. I'm getting nothing on my short-term bond funds. You know, maybe I'll nibble in stocks. You know, maybe now, you know, the world is not going to end, and this is the time to move in these assets. That is a type of psychology where you really begin to see that things are not going to fall apart, that I think are a precursor to a economic recovery.
John Taylor, at this point, it looks as though you may get the tax cut extension that you'd like. Why not layer this on top of that? I mean, clearly the economy is still sputtering.
Because it can be harmful. It was quite simply. The QE1, which really refers to these purchases of assets, long-term assets, that Seward mentioned at the beginning, that really occurred after the panic. And I don't disagree with Jeremy about the Fed's actions during the panic as being helpful, but most of QE1 was purchases of mortgage-backed securities and treasuries, and I don't see those as been helpful. So you got to distinguish that. But I say right now we have a low interest rate. The economy is not growing, I think, because of the uncertainty. So we address that uncertainty. We don't pump out more money. If a bank's sitting on, say, $2 million, and you give it $2,500,000, What difference is that going to make? They already have the $2 million to lend, and they're not lending that. So giving them some more just doesn't seem to me to make any sense. You got so much liquidity out there already. And so it's the economy. It's the businesses wanting to expand. The uncertainty there that should be addressed. And this policy, I'm concerned, makes it worse because there's not agreement on how it works.
Well, it's going to we got so much on the line here, and I guess it is now. It is the policy. It's going to roll out, and we'll see what happens. We really appreciate the insights today. People really have so much riding on this economy. John Taylor at Stanford, it's great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jeremy Siegel at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Professor Siegel, thank you to you.
It's been a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
And Sewell Chan, your reporting has been terrific on this. Thank you very much for your time today, Sewell.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Good luck. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.